Studying history, including your own family history, can be fascinating. And if one of your ancestors happened to write the original novel Dracula, well, how cool is that? And there might be a little actual history involved in that story.
From a historical basis, it was connected to a real person.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll talk to the great-grandnephew and keeper of the estate of Bram Stoker. We'll also spend an academic minute looking for less famous vampires. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. Taking on the family business can be pretty interesting when the business is curating the legacy of the most notorious vampire in literature. Dacre Stoker is the great-grandnephew of Bram Stoker, the author of the original 1897 novel, Dracula. Since then, there have been hundreds of interpretations on the character in print as well as on the stage and screen. A few years ago, Dacre wanted to add his own take on the Count's story and write a sequel to the original novel that bore the Stoker name. That book, Dracula the Undead, was written with co-author Ian Holt and released in 2009. In 2018, he collaborated with J.D. Barker on a prequel to the original called Dracul. Dacre Stoker was raised in Montreal and taught at Appleby College in Ontario before moving to the U.S. He is a former member of the Canadian men's pentathlon team and coached the team at the 1988 Summer Olympics in Seoul, South Korea. I asked how he went from that to becoming the keeper of the Stoker estate.
Well, it was a little bit by default. The short story is Bram was one of seven children. Only three of them had offspring. Obviously, he had a son, the son had a daughter, and then the Stoker name in that family has died out. But there are still some great-grandsons and further lineage in that line. But those two fellows, my cousins, are retired chartered accountants. They're not really into writing. They like to read. They are actually the owners of the intellectual property. But Bram's youngest brother, George Stoker, had a son, Tom, who moved to Canada after World War I. That's how my branch of the Stoker started. And I was sort of on this genealogy quest, God, about 15 years ago, just trying to figure out all the connections between George, my dad, and his other brothers. And one of my father's brothers was slowly dying of a heart disease. And he said, Dacre, you seem to be interested. I need to give you access to all this material. And being the eldest son and the eldest Stoker, he was the guy that received all this stuff. There's boxes of things in a storage unit in Montreal. My wife and I went up there with the laptop and our scanner, and we scanned all sorts of cool things, and we just thought, you know, this is really too good to let go. And if we did, there'd be another generation in our family that wouldn't know what was really going on or what the connections were between George Stoker and us, and even George was really famous himself. He invented ozone therapy, but obviously in the popular culture world, people are more concerned about my great-granduncle Bram. And there was correspondence as George and Bram were very close. George actually lived with him for a number of years before he got married and was working in a hospital. And that sort of spurred me on to start doing all kinds of other things, reading about the other biographies that were written by Bram. And some of them just didn't have a great degree of accuracy based on what little I knew. So I figured I'm going to have to go out and learn all this information myself. Started going to conferences, you know, anytime I could go to a lecture or something to do with one of the movies, you know, just start absorbing all this stuff. But at the same time, reading anything I could about Bram, finding who the experts were, questioning them on this, and going to libraries, museums around the world that had letters and papers by Bram or about Bram, and just sort of compiling my own library and my own sense of knowledge about, you know, who Bram was and what he was. And finally, you know, the novel Dracula, obviously I've read that numerous times, and that's what sort of spurred me on to saying, well, there's more to meets the eye with this novel and his writing process, and what events in Bram's life really led to him to be in the position to write this novel. That I found very interesting, and that sort of spurred me on to where I am today.
Is the character of Dracula in public domain now, or is that still owned by the family?
No. Really, there's nothing still owned by the family besides unpublished work that anybody finds of Bram's. The novel is in public domain. The character is in public domain. The film rights, I even believe, have expired. Bram's widow sold those a long time ago. Originally, the stage rights to that Hamilton Dean and John Balderston adapted the first stage play, and then they sold those off to Universal and Hammer. That's long gone, the family. So we, as the family, don't make a penny on any royalties nowadays, although we did find in Bram's, one of his cousins' attic, a journal of Bram's. And since that had not been published, I did publish this. I edited it with a Dr. Elizabeth Miller called Bram Stoker's Lost Journal. That came out in 2012. And that has a 25-year period of protection under the Berne Convention. And so we are collecting royalties from that one book, but it's mostly because me and Dr. Elizabeth Miller deciphered it and actually made comments on it. But otherwise, the family made good money back in the day. But it's not, you know, the current vampire craze, or let's just say the last 123 years of vampire craze, we're not profiting on. It's really a labor of love and deep interest into our relative and what makes him tick. And that's really kind of gets my attention.
But that name Dracula is almost like a magnet when it's on a title of a book or a movie, isn't it?
Well, I mean, you're absolutely correct, Bob. I mean, it is so identifiable. Just the sound of it, what it means to people when somebody says, you know, Dracula. But also, you know, from a historical basis, it was connected to a real person. Vlad Dracula III was the guy that Bram saw in two books. We've now realized what his research process was. All the books that he used for research have been found in the London Library and the Whitby Library and other libraries. And I actually am a little bit crazy about this, but I buy up first editions of the same books that are sitting in these libraries so I can read the entire book and see what got into Bram's head. And why did he choose this Vlad Dracula III, the Impaler from Wallachia? Why did he switch to Transylvania? You know, all these little things that he did that other writers and screenwriters will adapt and inspired by themselves. You know, they'll take what Bram did and go in such slightly different directions. And in certain cases, you know, make Bram's Count Dracula Vlad the Impaler, whereas Bram really only borrowed his name. And to some extent, that infuriates some people in Romania. And in some cases, they absolutely love it because it means great tourism. And I've been over there now 10 times. I lead tours over there now. And it's a lot of fun because people are now realizing that what I stand for is let's try to set the record straight. Where are the locations in the novel that Bram used? Where are the locations where Vlad Dracula the Impaler actually was? Bram didn't intend to merge the two characters, but writers have. I have. Ian Holt and I did in Dracula the Undead, because that's what we thought would be interesting to our readers. But in Dracul, the prequel to Dracula, we chose to keep him, you know, more pure and not merge him into that Wallachian prince.
I'm going to say, so many writers have taken this character in so many directions. Where do you want to take him?
Oh, boy. That's a great question, because I've taken him in really two directions. So I've continued the novel Dracula with the first book that I wrote that came out in 2009. I continued the story because what's so cool, Bob, is that at the end of Dracula, the ending is somewhat ambiguous. That the fact that the knife was thrust into Dracula's heart and caused him to crumble into dust and not a stake driven into his heart. To me, that is Bram Stoker saying, I'm not actually killing him. It's Dracula's way to escape because there was no wooden stake handy. And Bram went into great great detail earlier in the novel to say the only way to kill a vampire is with a stake in the heart. So why at the end of the novel, when all the band of heroes are ready to, you know, they've got the guys, they've got the gypsies surrounded, they move in, slit the throat, and a knife in the heart, and he goes into dust. Well, my idea was, if he's not completely dead, he needs to recover, he comes back. Where is he going? And what about the son, the child that's born at the end of the novel, that when they go back to Transylvania to pay homage to their dead friend, Quincy Morris? So he's still immortal. And, you know, I try to keep close to what Bram did, but, you know, modernize it a little bit. Now, in the recent book that's been a real international bestseller and number one in the UK, which is very satisfying, we go back to the very beginnings of Bram Stoker himself and try to figure out what would have been a plausible explanation for Bram writing this novel. And what is such a cool hook, Bob, is that Bram really was an invalid child for the first 7 years of his life. We don't know what caused it. But I'm a sports guy. I've done athletic training all the way up through the Olympic level, and I've seen people recover from injuries and be just decimated by injuries. But it's like, how did this kid at 7 years old become a champion athlete at Trinity University in a numerous of sports 5 years after he recovered from this illness? And it's like, okay, I can play with this. This is the hook a writer needs. Let's say instead of him being bloodlet by his uncle, that I really believe he was, maybe there was something in the blood that he got. Maybe there's some vampiric intervention. So what I did was, you know, fictionalize the real stuff that happened to his life and looked at what were people really believing at that time in the late 1800s about vampirism. So a ton of research later is like, this stuff, some people believed it was real. So that's what I blended in to coming back to really the beginning of your question is, what am I trying to do with Dracula? I'm trying to go back to the source of it and analyzing this novel and seeing what other directions could Bram have gone with it. And that's what J.D. Barker and I felt. And luckily, a lot of people have really enjoyed it. And, you know, Paramount bought the film rights. So I think hopefully it will be enjoyed by many people on the silver screen at some time in the future.
So I'm assuming you did not insert Abbott and Costello in there.
That's great. No, but, you know, even that is cool. You know, it's like, to me, if what Bram created inspires people to go in many directions, and comedy is one of them. I mean, we could sit here for another half an hour and talk about all the comedy varieties, Leslie Nielsen, David Niven, all these other guys. What We Do in the Shadows is a more recent sort of comedy adaptation. That just shows that this product has sort of moved beyond just gothic horror. It's gone into soap operas, you know, with years ago when I was a kid growing up, you know, in Canada watching Dark Shadows.
Sure, Barnabas Collins, man, yeah.
Yeah, but Dark, you know, Dark Shadows is, but the Munsters and the Addams Family, and then you go into Scooby-Doo and the whole Buffy world. So this is, as you mentioned earlier, it's everywhere, popular culture. And it's not just Halloween, you know, it's all the time, which is so cool. You can't turn around and not be confronted by it some way or another, which I think is cool. And I think Bram would have thought that is really awesome.
Do you find that there is a definitive cinema version of Dracula or a stage version?
Wonderful question. There, in my opinion, and boy, oh boy, do people have lots of different opinions on this, especially, you know, coming out since the BBC Netflix co-production written by Moffat and Gaddis has kind of reimagined the whole thing. And I actually sat in Dublin, Ireland in October at the Bram Stoker Festival where I was presenting as well about Dracula and Bram's life. They presented about their story. And they said, and this is to answer your question, they said, you know, the BBC did a very faithful adaptation of the novel back in 1977. And Louis Jourdan was the Dracula character. And I still think to that day that's the closest, most faithful adaptation of the novel, but it was a three-part miniseries. On stage, the challenge was, and it still is to this day, when you read the novel Dracula, there are so many different perspectives from the different characters as to what is going on. Of course, it was written for your listeners in the epistolary style, so it's journals, diary entries, all of these different perspectives, and that made it very, very difficult to stage because of the expense of the set designs and set changes. It would be, you know, somebody would talk for a page or two pages. This is what I'm thinking. And then it'd be another one. So it would drive the stage manager and everybody crazy. So I don't think there is a definitive stage adaptation out there. You know, they've adapted it to musicals, to opera. Movies is a little bit easier because, but it makes it very expensive with all these period sets and so on. And now I think what's sort of interesting is with the streaming content that is being out there on Netflix and HBO and Showtime and all these others, there's more possibility if somebody wanted to create a very faithful adaptation to the novel, it would need to at least be, you know, some sort of 12-part miniseries. But I will just say while we're on it, I would encourage people to look at this BBC Netflix co-pro because it's a reimagined version of the novel, but they've picked up on certain parts of the novel that Bram only touched on, which is obviously the convent and the action that's going on in the Demeter. They had a whole hour and a half series on each of those, which was only a few pages of the novel. So my hat's off to them to be creative. And then I won't, you know, talk much about the third episode because that would be a big spoiler. But it's interesting that this novel is continuously it's attracting good talent to reimagine it, to adapt it, to be inspired by it, even 123 years after this thing was published.
Still to come, our conversation with Dacre Stoker continues with a look at Stoker's interactions with students and why they are still attracted to this gothic character. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett, and our guest today is Dacre Stoker, the great-grandnephew of Bram Stoker, the author of Dracula. He is the keeper of the Stoker estate and legacy and has written books about both his ancestor and his ancestor's famous creation, Count Dracula. Stoker gives presentations around the world about the history of Dracula in literature and in the real world. I asked him what students usually ask him when he talks about the good count and his famous ancestor.
Yeah, I guess one of the questions I get, do you believe in vampires? Did Bram Stoker believe in vampires? You know, you get that level because I bring to them with my keynote presentation, which is like PowerPoint, but for apples, I show them Bram's notes. I show them the manuscript. I show a lot of his writing process. I show a lot of the stuff that he went through. And I really like to show people that this is a normal person, just like all of us. And he was a student like you guys, but what he did was he had certain things in his life that caused him to develop a very dark sense of imagination. But he also went against the odds in his family. He had three brothers that were scientists. They became doctors and a civil servant and two sisters trained seriously in the arts. He was the only guy that kind of went into literature against his father's wishes. He was a civil servant at the time. And my message coming out of all this is he followed his passion and he wanted to write. He loved the theater and this sort of escapism type thing. But he also really was very hardworking and did a lot of research for it. It wasn't just, oh, yeah, I want to be a writer, jot down some things that come to my mind, you know, when I'm in the shower or going for a walk. He did a lot of research on all of his stuff, and he kept his notes. So that's what you know, students ask me about that process. What kind of a guy was he like? And I really like talking about him because, you know, he is my relative, and I'm proud of him. And for somebody that had humble beginnings just outside of Dublin, Ireland, to do something that has changed the world, you know, and to this day it's going as strong as ever, it's pretty impressive. And I like to spread that message.
Well, speaking of his notes, are there any more notes? Are there any more unfinished works that might be able to be fleshed out into a new novel?
The Dracula notes are in a museum in Philadelphia, and they've been published in facsimile edition by two friends of mine, Robert 18 Bisang and Dr. Elizabeth Miller. Miller was the one that I did the Lost Journal with, and I'm actually working on an annotated Dracula with Robert 18 Bisang right now. They're not new, but since we discover new things, and one of them is the books in the London Library just last year, that gives us a different look at the novel. I have combed through his great-grandson's book collection, and there are some letters and journals in there by Bram's son that someday I will bring to light. There is a Dracula manuscript that Paul Allen, the co-founder of Microsoft, who's no longer living, but he purchased it and it saves it and allows people to go out to Seattle to look at it. Will we find anything else? I do know a fellow that did find an unfinished story. I'm not privy to say the name of it, but it was an unfinished story, and we've been chatting about maybe sort of trying to finish it ourselves if we can sort of replicate what Bram would have said, you know, in our best guess. So because he wrote so many letters, because he, you know, died fairly young, there may be some more things that pop up. Who knows? It would be very cool to find another piece. But the other thing is, I'm trying to also work on bringing some of his short stories back to life in a method that could give a wider audience, and that is through graphic novels. And that's one thing that I've met certain guys, and I'm working with a guy from England who actually has a connection in Hollywood with Marvel to actually adapt one of them, just to see how do we do it, what's the writing process, what's the art process. So some of the stuff is obviously been out there for a long time. We're just trying to represent it in a way that would give a big audience to this day.
It's interesting because Marvel has been doing Dracula comics for decades.
Yeah, but some of the Bram's short stories and other stories haven't been exploited in a great way. And so that could be cool to bring them back out the same way.
All right. Well, what's next for you? What's next for Dracula? Is he coming back? Is there another book coming?
Well, you know, we JD and I purposely ended Dracul at the exact date, 1890, when Bram Stoker was about to head off to Whitby, England for his holiday, when everything sort of formed in his mind and started writing the novel Dracula. We've in our novel Dracul, it's like why he wrote it, what things he knew. But there's a 7-year gap that we've left open from the time he started penning the novel to when it actually came out. So our agent has said, don't start writing it yet. Wait until the movie of Dracul comes out, and then your sequel will be in greater demand. So that's one piece. The other thing that I'm actually doing is I'm working with two guys right now who are documentary filmmakers to actually take some of my journeys to find all this information that I put into my Stoker on Stoker presentations that I give all over the world, trying to add some a documentary element to it. For instance, last summer I was at the same mountaintop in northern Transylvania, right next to the Borgo Pass, that in Bram Stoker's Notes for Dracula, a friend of mine, Hans de Roos, actually found in the notes lines of longitude and latitude, references to rivers and towns, and has been able to pinpoint the mountaintop where Bram set his fictional castle. And so I was there with the blessing of the national park, with a lot of press from Transylvania and a film crew putting a plaque designating this as the spot on top of Mount Israel. So that's the kind of thing I'm doing, is sort of these trips are great fun and I take some tourists on them. But if I can turn them into sort of a short documentary, I can get them to a wider audience. And to me, that's a lot of fun because the whole journey has been just an absolute gas. More I can learn about Bram, the better, but I like to bring it to lots of folks.
Didn't think this was going to happen when you were training for the Olympics, did you?
You know, I thought that was the pinnacle of my career, you know, being at the Olympic Games in 88 and coaching a young lady who became world champion. But, you know, if you stick to it and you have fun while you're doing it, just, you know, the best advice I give to folks, you know, be like me, keep going. And you never know what you're going to turn up next if you keep doing your homework and keep, you know, Googling things and going to libraries. All kinds of cool stuff will turn up, and it certainly does.
Well, if there's anything in Bram's book that is absolutely true, it is that Dracula is immortal. It'll be around forever.
Agreed on that one. Absolutely.
Dacre Stoker is the great-grandnephew of Bram Stoker, the author of Dracula. He has co-authored the sequel called Dracula the Undead and the prequel called Dracul. He also directed, produced, and wrote the 2011 documentary film Dracula Meets Stoker. You can learn more about Dacre and the Stoker estate and legacy at DacreStoker.com. Sure, when it comes to vampires, Count Dracula is a pretty big name, but what about those other, lesser-known vampires? That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Vampires are more than just Dracula. I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Tracy Betzinger, associate professor in the Department of Anthropology at SUNY Oneonta, looks into a different European vampire legend.
When we think of vampires, we conjure up Hollywood images of pale, fang-toothed, bloodthirsty creatures on the prowl for necks to bite. But when we look at the history behind vampire lore, the truth is almost as strange as fiction. In 17th and 18th century Poland, vampires were indeed considered evil creatures that rose from the grave to cause disease or death to humans. However, they were believed to be reanimated corpses, more like zombies than the cape-wearing, bat-morphing gentlemen who can't see their own reflections. In the cemetery where I did my research, it was clear that a few skeletons had received anti-vampiristic treatments. Several individuals had been buried with sickles across the throat. My colleagues and I believe this was meant to cut the head off the body should it become reanimated and try to sit up. Some of the bodies had stones beneath their chins, possibly to keep the mouth shut so the corpses couldn't chew through their burial shrouds and bite victims. What was interesting was that this anti-vampiristic treatment wasn't limited to one specific demographic. The people who were buried this way were adults and children, both male and female. None exhibited any out-of-the-ordinary health issues, nor were they strangers. They were all from the local community. So what was it about these particular individuals that made their peers target them and label them as vampires? We are left with a variety of possible culturally based explanations, including not being baptized, committing suicide, even practicing witchcraft. There was no one common reason that all of these people were targeted. Instead, they each had some type of perceived risk factor for vampirism that fed the superstitions of the time, and as a result, made them subject to the strange and intriguing burial treatment.
That was Tracy Betzinger of SUNY Oneonta. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. And you can find us on Twitter at @TBOOKnowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.